Hi, I'm Claire Sadler. Welcome to our special SITREP Live here from Shape near Mons in Belgium. We're here to ask what the future holds for NATO in its 75th year. We're delighted to be joined by Admiral Sir Keith Blount, the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe. And we're hoping over the next 40 minutes or so to look at the challenges facing the alliance in that rapidly changing world, the lessons learned from Ukraine, and so much more. And we're also pleased to have Professor Michael Clark. We're also really pleased to have an international audience of personnel here at Shape.
This is SITREP.
So without further ado, thank you for joining us. First of all, perhaps before we go into the difficulties facing the alliance, perhaps you'd give us a little bit of an idea about what Shape does.
Right, well, we are the military strategic headquarters that sort of sits below the NATO headquarters in Brussels, so that's where the political apparatus is situated. They have some military people there as well. But ultimately, we take some steerage and direction from there. But then we look after all of Allied command operations, which is executed through a series of headquarters, joint force headquarters, domain-specific headquarters that are situated all around our area of responsibility to make sure that all of the military activity is coordinated and delivers what the Supreme Allied Commander requires.
And you're the first naval desacreur for at least 20 years, I think. So what do you think that naval background brings to your role?
Well, I think the first thing to point out is that 80% of SACUR's area of responsibility is wet. So there's a lot of sea out there.
Yeah.
And I think we are realizing that as we see what's going on in Ukraine, as we start to look again about collective defense, there's a lot of maritime within that as a dimension that we need to consider. So it definitely helps in that respect. But of course, it's about all of the domains. But the Navy and the maritime is an important one.
So let's start looking perhaps then at the challenges. So looking back over the 75 years of NATO, what do you think has been perhaps one of the biggest challenges facing the alliance?
So I think one of the biggest challenges, ironically, is probably now. You know, we built up quite quickly from 1949 into a very strong political military alliance, the best, the biggest, the most successful in the world's history, for sure. And I sense that even though it was a very fragile period of peace throughout the Cold War, there was a rationale for the alliance. There was something that was very easy to understand in the way that it faced Russia. Now, since the end of the Cold War, what we're now seeing is a kind of a rebirth, if you like, of that collective defense focus. And that, of course, has been quite an interesting period for the alliance, one that we are wrestling with, but nevertheless a challenge for sure.
And Mike, perhaps we can bring you in here when to look at strategic shifts.
Yeah.
What's the biggest one, perhaps, from your perspective that you've seen over that time?
Oh, well, the biggest strategic shift now is the end of the post-Cold War. Mm. You know, we had the Cold War, we had the post-Cold War, we got the peace dividend. It was very nice. It was, you know, we earned it, but it's over. It's over. And I'm sure the Admiral would agree with this. I mean, European security will never be the same again after 2022. And although this organisation is pretty clear about that, I'm not sure that all of the governments that contribute to this organisation are fully on board with that. And, you know, and I wonder, Admiral, that when NATO was 12 and then it was 16, now it's 32. Mm. So it's a bigger political problem to manage. But militarily, managing at 32, I mean, what does the other 16, how difficult is that to manage in a military 32 as opposed to a political 32? What are the differences?
Well, I think, you know, it's a nice problem to have,
yeah.
Having 32 nations. And some of the most recent joiners, Sweden and Finland, I mean, they bring a real punch. And they bring a way of thinking that is actually quite Cold War in its way of thinking. I mean, they're very used to facing down Russia, quite comfortable with that, and actually bring something into the alliance that is quite fresh in that sense. But I mean, there are inevitably challenges in coordinating and cohering large military forces from that number of nations. But I sense through the new concept that we have written, which is called the Defence and Deterrence of the Euro-Atlantic Area, we've really got a framework We've got a very strong framework in which that coordination can take place. And I think SATCUR is pretty comfortable with where we are. We need some more forces in certain areas in order that we can maintain and, in fact, accelerate some of our capability trajectories. But overall, this is a good problem to have.
So perhaps let's move on to threats then. Where would you say at the moment that the biggest threat is coming from?
Russia. So, you know, as an alliance, we're very clear in where we see potential adversaries, and Russia and terror groups are the two. But given the events since the 24th of February in 2022, we are very, very focused on Russia right now. We're focused on other things as well. I mean, and China isn't lost on us, and what's going on in the Middle East, of course, these things are not lost on us. But as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, our focus is principally on Russia.
So we'll probably return to China and some of those other threats in a moment. But in relation to Russia, how is NATO boosting its capabilities?
Well, we have a number of ways in which we go about that. I mean, the first thing that we've had to do is have a really good stock take of exactly what we've got. Mm. Which sounds straightforward, but it links to the question the professor asked. Mm. You know, it's a complicated beast when you're dealing with 32 nations. But we've done a lot of baselining, and we're pretty clear where we're very strong and where we need to become stronger, for sure. That's helpful. That delta, the difference between the two, is something that drives our defence planning process, the NATO defence planning process, which is a big piece of machinery, very sophisticated, where we work with every single nation, set capability targets and say, go after them and buy them.
And what about exercises? We've seen that, I think it's Steadfast Noon just started, hasn't it? How critical are exercises in that process?
Absolutely fundamental. Really, really fundamental, whether or not we're training, whether we are demonstrating, whether we are just exercising, whether we are demonstrating deterrence, whatever it may be. We use the exercise program in a variety of different ways, and therefore making sure that it keeps up with the situations that the alliance is facing is one of the things that we are really focused on.
Okay, and perhaps Ukraine. I mean, that is a critical issue at the moment, isn't it? So when it comes to NATO support for Ukraine, how has that changed the alliance's approach to collective defence, as it were?
Well, it's really reset the alliance thinking, and I think it goes back before 2022. I mean, it goes back arguably as far as 2008 with Georgia, certainly 2014 with Crimea, 2022 definitely. So as the professor has already explained to us, you know, this is not crisis management. I mean, this is a return to a long-term view on the requirement for collective defence. And Ukraine, Russia, the lessons we're learning from that has absolutely forced us to rethink everything, really, and to go back to some of our Cold War thinking, but to bring it bang up to date with contemporary military thinking as well. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Mike, perhaps you can come in there. You know, what are the lessons that have been learned by other militaries around the world from Ukraine in relation to military warfighting?
Well, one of the lessons I think we've all learned is that it's full spectrum warfare, from trenches that our grandfathers would have understood, great-grandfathers, right through to Starlink and Space Wars, Star Wars. Full spectrum, that it's the return of industrial age warfare, which means that the side that will prevail is the side that can mobilise its full resources. And the Russians are clearly determined to do that at whatever cost. The West is trying to mobilise its resources on behalf of Ukraine, but again, that's a slightly problematical issue. We're trying to fight or help the Ukrainians fight this war without inconveniencing ourselves too much, which is the problem. So we're learning a lot from this, and it's the return of full-on warfare. You've got to be prepared for it, and goes back to what the Admiral said about defence and deterrence. In my day, we used to talk about deterrence, by which we meant nuclear weapons, but deterrence is about the ability to show an adversary that we will not roll over, and that we actually can hit back if necessary, and we can defend what we say we need to defend. And we've got to get back some of that deterrence. We let it slip, I'm sure we did. The fact that Putin did what he did in 2022 shows that we let it slip. We've got to get it back. And I think that's the big lesson of Ukraine now.
And Admiral, part of your role, I think, as DSACR, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's force generation. Mm. So how has Ukraine changed that? Has it made your job easier or...?
So I think in one way it's made it easier, because the question I put to allies, to the nations, the capitals, is if, God forbid, if we found ourselves in conflict, where the entire alliance was activated, which capabilities would you not give to the alliance? Mm. And if you frame the question in that way, then nations are pretty much all in. So in that sense, Ukraine has allowed me to ask that question with an evidential underpinning. That means that we are starting to see pretty much everything that nations have on the table. That's been helpful. And therefore, the baselining of the capability that we have has been easier to achieve. So that has been helpful. The hardest bit now, as Mike has already told us, is getting after where we have the delta, where we don't enjoy all of the advantage that we would wish. Mm. That's the bit now that needs to be to become a reality.
So do you think NATO will be ready to fight a war?
Oh, for sure. There's no question. And it's really important that listeners and viewers feel very, very confident in that. But of course, we want to fight a war if it were ever needed. First of all, we don't want to start one. And that's not NATO's business. I mean, as a defensive alliance, it's very much as it says on the tin. Collective defense is where it's at. But if we needed to defend the alliance, we want to be able to do it very swiftly and decisively and with a minimum loss.
Mike, you wanted to come
yeah,
in?
I mean, absolutely agree with what you're saying. The enablers, all the enablers that make the numbers and the heavy metal work, they're there, but a high proportion of them are American, and the Europeans are not great at providing the enablers in enough numbers, and you must live with that on a monthly basis, that sort of worry. And the danger, isn't it, is that the US enablers might switch to the Indo-Pacific. In time, they all will, I'm sure, most of them will, and they might switch quite quickly in the 2020s. Is there not a danger of a sort of enablers gap opening up between European NATO and American enablers that will just leave Europe sometime maybe soon and maybe in total?
Well, when we're talking about planning for any eventuality, there are always areas of risk. I mean, that's part of the business that, you know, that's part of the business we're in, as is, of course, mitigating those risks. And there's a truth, I mean, to the way in which the alliance has operated since the end of the Cold War, enjoying the peace dividend that we have, ultimately becoming involved in things that have not classically been part of NATO's business, often outside our area of responsibility, doing things like counter-piracy, as an example, things that have not really been normal business. So as we return to what was NATO's core business, then, of course, we are identifying those areas where we don't enjoy all of the advantage that we require. But the prioritisation within capitals, the UK right now itself is starting to give weight to this through its own strategic defence review. Mm-hmm. This is where we just need to see us ultimately doing the right housekeeping around our military capabilities to make sure we're not caught short.
And Admiral, you joined the Navy in 1984, I think, so you have a significant amount of maritime background. So with that in mind, and the addition of Sweden and Finland, what do you think that sort of brings to the alliance in relation to maritime strategy?
Yes, so 1984 is a long time ago, and I've only just been back to Dartmouth College to celebrate with many others that landmark. And we were sort of going through lots of sort of statistics as to who was top of the pops and what were the headlines in the newspapers and things. But one of the headlines from the perspective in which we are talking was that the UK was spending 5.9% on GDP on defence. So that was right in full throttle Cold War mode, you know, and I can remember very much being a part of the tail end of the Cold War, particularly when I was flying helicopters. And I sense that is part of the military strategy that we are now rethinking. Deep water, Atlantic, anti-submarine warfare, the importance of the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap, the absolute essential nature of the High North, the way in which what we describe as the strategic lines of communication, the way in which we need the Atlantic to enjoy a freedom of action and manoeuvre to allow things to move across, classically from west to east. All of these things now are becoming far more focal in the way that we're thinking. Fortunately, there are still a few experienced officers, shall we say, like me, that can remember how we used to do it. So we're just making sure that we don't lose all of that experience.
So what more do you think NATO needs to do in those areas?
Well, I'm an admiral, so I'm never going to ask for less ships or submarines. So, you know, you definitely need hard military capability, but you also need to be able to operate it well. We are very fortunate in the Western navies, in the Alliance navies. We have the most exquisite, sophisticated equipment, and it works really, really well. But of course, it can't be in two places at once. So there is something about mass. There's no doubt about that. There's something about making sure that we've got all the bombs, the bullets, the rockets that we need. There's something about training and exercising. All of these things are really important. But I wouldn't want your viewers and listeners to think that we weren't absolutely on that, or indeed that we'd really let the end go. We haven't. In many areas, we're still as good as we always have been. But we definitely need to, we still need, obviously, to consolidate in areas.
Mike, how strategic is the High North?
Yeah, very. I was going to ask the Admiral, with Sweden and Finland coming into the alliance, and they are far and away the two most significant new entrants since the mid-1990s, does that, from our point of view, NATO's point of view, does that make the Baltic a NATO lake? Does it worry the Russians? I mean, I know that Sweden and Finland coming into the alliance really worries the Russians.
Yeah.
But do they really now worry about the Baltic?
Oh, I'm sure they do. Yeah. And you know, this is where we mustn't paint the Russians as 10 feet tall. I mean, you know, they not only have they made some real clangers in the way that they've approached Ukraine, equally, when you look at the military advantage that the alliance enjoys in the Baltic, you know, if you were looking at that through a Russian lens, you really, really would not like to think of it. And of course, you draw attention to Sweden and Finland. But in 2004, the Baltic nations came in themselves, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia.
Yeah.
So, of course, that's what's which is ring-fenced them. So although we think a lot about Kaliningrad and the Suwalki Gap, as you would expect us to, I bet the Russians do as well. Mm.
I was going to say, but what about in the High North? I mean, look at the investment the Russians are putting into the Arctic.
Of course.
I mean, that's got to be a concern, isn't it?
I mean,
as global warming opens up the Northwest Passage, the famous Northwest Passage,
yes.
It's sod's law that it's opening up on the Russian side.
Yeah.
And that's just the luck of the draw.
Yes, of course. And this is where we have to use allies that are members of the Arctic Council and other forums just to keep tabs on everything that's going on. I sometimes think that when we talk about the High North and the Northern Sea Route, that because of climate change, people are sort of imagining people sat there on the beach with a strawberry daiquiri enjoying the sun. I mean, this is still quite pioneering maritime activity to get from one end of that route to the other. But for sure, this is a burgeoning challenge for the alliance, and not just for the alliance as well, actually, for other nations too. But it is one that we are tracking very carefully.
All right, so looking a little bit further afield then, and looking at China, do you consider China to be an issue? What's NATO doing about that?
So China is definitely coming into NATO's lexicon. If you go back a few summits, China didn't appear in the communique. Mm-hmm. So it appeared for the first time in Madrid, and I think we wrote two lines on it. And then in Vilnius, I think they got maybe two and a bit. And now in the Washington communique, they got 24 lines over two paragraphs. So there's definitely an increasing dialogue and discussion around China. From an alliance perspective, it doesn't change our two adversaries that we are really focused on, potential adversaries in Russia and, of course, terror groups that are forever there. But China is definitely one of the areas that we are aware of. And, of course, it's not just China as a nation, it's actually the Indo-Pacific. I think sometimes we imagine that the area of responsibility that NATO has almost is like some sort of boxing ring with ropes around it in which a fair fight is going to take place. Well, let's not forget Vladivostok as a Russian base is in the Pacific, and the Chinese-Russian axis and the way in which they are working together, talking together, spending money together is, of course, not lost on the alliance.
And the security landscape keeps evolving. We've got cyber threats, hybrid attacks, and unmanned vehicles, of course, as well. So how is NATO changing its plans to deal with those?
So I think we're doing that in a number of different ways. I mean, for a start, we brought on board the two new domains, as we call them. So classically, NATO was organized into sort of land, sea and air. And now we talk about cyber and space. In ways that we haven't in the past. So about integrating the capabilities, opportunities and risks that those new domains ultimately provide us into the way in which NATO thinks, exercises and trains is really key. Getting after offensive cyber as well as defensive cyber is another one of those areas that, of course, the alliance is thinking about. In terms of hybrid warfare, well, of course, we do that as well. In fact, if you just, we were talking about the Baltic recently, but I mean, the cyber center of excellence is in Estonia, the NATO cyber center of excellence in Estonia, the hybrid warfare center of excellence in Lithuania, autonomous systems center of excellence here in Belgium. But I would, at this point, name check our strategic mirror headquarters over in Norfolk, Virginia, Allied Command Transformation. That's where through their not just through sort of strategies like the NATO warfighting capstone concept, but also through their practice, they are really helping us in identify the capability pathway of how to get after new innovative technologies over the next 20-year horizon so that we absolutely can consider ourselves world leaders in and around hybrid as well as cyber and other areas of new warfighting.
Mike, perhaps your thoughts really on unmanned vehicles. We've seen such huge changes, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, you know, drones, for want of a better word. They've been around for a long time, but what's new now, and it's not revolutionary, but it changes, it step changes the threat or the problem. One is sheer numbers, and the miniaturization of these things, and two, put you know, swarming drones into an AI system, so a drone doesn't have to be controlled by a single person. 1,000 drones can be controlled by a single person and given an area of operations, and you might say, well, for the next 12 hours that's a free fire zone, let AI decide on the targets and do it. That is I'm avoiding using the word revolutionary, but that is different. And this started in the Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict in 2019. Suddenly, the Azerbaijanis using Turkish drones in numbers that we'd never used in Afghanistan or Iraq, using them in numbers with Israeli drones as surveillance, actually knocked out Russian tanks. Mm. I mean, lots of Russian tanks. And we in the West really began to take notice, didn't we, after 2019?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And, you know, and the Ukrainian Navy has been hugely successful without ships. So for sure, we need to make sure that we harness all of those opportunities. But I used a term in answer to the last question about what I would describe as the capability pathway. It's one thing to be able to identify all of the new capabilities and the opportunities that they present through artificial intelligence, swarming technologies, remote on autonomous systems. I mean, and you can do a quick Google search on this, or put it through an AI search engine, and you'll come up with some wickedly devilish military capabilities potentially that are out there. No doubt, one of the challenges is getting from where we are now to there, because at some point you need to make really big and courageous capability decisions to say, right, we're not going to build another class of frigate. Or we're not going to build another class of crewed aircraft. We are going to step away and we're going to leap in. And of course, one of the great debates is whether you leap or whether you step gently. Because if you do get it wrong, you're left very, very exposed. So, it's an interesting challenge for the alliance to make sure that we go at the right pace so that we don't fall behind the technology curve, but equally we don't end up almost hedging bets on capabilities that then we find are not quite as solid as we need them to be.
So is it really about investment, being bold with investment, do you think?
So there's a lot about investment, a lot about operational experimentation. But again, what we're learning from Ukraine is that what I would describe as complementary capabilities are being hugely valued. So you can use drones, you can use all sorts of autonomous systems, including artificial intelligence, as capabilities that complement more traditional capabilities. So using drones for spotting artillery fire, as an example, or using drones to actually conduct some form of attack as a either as a diversion to a more conventional attack or whatever. where the real gains can be had is when you actually start thinking in terms of replacement capabilities, where you're replacing an entire conventional way of doing something with something that is very, very different. They are the areas that carry the most risk, but potentially the greatest opportunities. And in order to make sure we bet on the right things, we need a lot of operational experimentation and, for sure, money for research and development.
Mm-hmm. And so what about terrorism? What is NATO doing about the threat of terrorism?
Well, as I've said, I think in a couple of answers, I mean, we've written terrorism into every plan that we write and into every document ultimately that we produce. And we are held to account by nations within the alliance, quite rightly, for making sure that we balance properly the risks from terrorism with those of our other potential adversary in Russia. So a lot of activity and thought and indeed some planning around what we would do, not to respond to a terrorist attack, but also how we would deter and prevent it. It's a difficult one. It's a difficult one. It's a lot easier when you're imagining state-on-state conflict. It's a lot harder when you're operating in the area of non-state actors or the blurring of boundaries between state and non-state. You know, it's for sure challenging and difficult. And as history tells us, once in a while, regrettably, tragically, we get caught out. But we're doing a lot more thinking now than we've done hitherto to make sure we don't.
And Mike, how key is the challenge of misinformation and disinformation?
It's pretty fundamental because we live in a world of misinformation and disinformation. You know, it always used to be said, I mean, do you remember Norman Schwarzkopf in the 1991 Gulf War? And he always said, when we say something, it's got to be right. And you say, yes, General, but it'll be 48 hours behind the curve because CNN will have been reporting it then when CNN made its reputation in 1991, reporting things, which it then tracked back on. Said they said this. Well, no, actually, it didn't happen that way. We said this. And they were able to track back. And Norman Schwarzkopf said, look, when we say it, it's got to be right. And the challenge, isn't it, for an alliance is that You've got to give the full story first, or very early on, and it's got to be accurate, but it's got to be quick.
Yeah, it does, and I think you know the whole this whole area that you can put under an umbrella term of information operations of various different types is a new art and science, and it's evolving very, very quickly. So understanding what the truth is and where you're going to get it is becoming increasingly tricky. And the use of manipulated data, news feeds, you know, clearly the way in which bots can ultimately replicate and artificial intelligence can replicate people in what they speak and how they look in a way that is very difficult to discern from reality means that this space will be a challenge forevermore. And it always has been a challenge, incidentally, but it ain't getting any easier.
Let's talk about space, the sort of the new
Final
domain. Exactly. it's becoming increasingly important, isn't it, space? You know, people are talking about space a lot more now. So how is NATO adapting its strategies to address the potential threats in relation to space?
So we wrote a space policy in 2019 and took space into the fold as a domain in 2019. So that was 5 years ago. One of the mistakes that we could make, I don't think we've made it, but we could have made, is to try and treat space like one of the other domains, because it's not. It's extraordinarily different. And it links to some of the points that we've already reflected on, in that you're dealing with some military technology and capability that's up there, for sure. Most of it isn't military. Most of it isn't. It's owned. Some of it's owned by state. Some of it's owned by non-state. Some of it that's non-state owned, in particular just privately owned, is available to the highest bidder. Yeah. So you're dealing with a very complex domain, but one in which we are seeing large military developments in terms of anti-satellite technology, the ability to use space for long-range targeting and other facets in ways that are far more sophisticated now than they have ever been in the past. So what we have now is we have a space operations center at Ramstein. It's within the Aircom enclave, but it is it's considered as a distinct domain command, and that is operating actually as a very effective portal, really, to all of the national space entities. And the way that we work that is to go through that to a nation, and we ask nations to understand as best as they can their own space domain, if you will, so that we can kind of fuse it in a NATO sense. So it's difficult, but we are now starting to exercise and train with that space domain alongside the other domains in a way that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago. So we're definitely making huge progress fast.
Mike, do you think it's difficult for NATO countries to work together when it comes to space, in relation to space?
Well, potentially, it's more difficult than in some other areas because, you know, take low Earth orbit, which is the most useful in many ways. What, 8,000 active satellites there and loads of junk at the same time. Most of them, as the Admiral said, have been put there by private companies now. And you know, SpaceX is releasing literally dozens and dozens of new satellites every couple of months. And so it's very difficult, I think, to pull governments together on that. Partly because of the complexity of the process, and partly because, I think, as the Admiral implied, a lot of that's available to the highest bidder. And that's a very sort of strangely anarchic situation, you know, with a lot of capability available to the highest bidder. And some of the highest bidders will be non-state actors. Some of them, not hasn't quite happened yet, but it will soon, I think.
And how critical? Sorry, Admiral, you're going to say something.
No, I was going to agree with the point that Mike said, but equally just to reinforce it is that the alliance is quite used to recognising that within this group of 32 nations, nations share as much about themselves and their military capabilities as they as possible, should we say, which is a lot. So we know a lot about each other within the alliance. There are certain bits of capability that are quite siloed for a very, you know, various reasons. Nuclear capabilities would be a good example of that, and so with certain aspects of cyber, and now space. But the alliance has adapted to understand how we can leverage sovereign capabilities within an alliance wrapper in a way that does not necessarily require a nation to tell the other 31 of what it's doing. So I can't go into that in huge detail, but that's just one of the areas that the alliance has adapted to be able to bring capabilities like cyber and space closer to the more conventional capabilities.
And do you think that the alliance needs to focus on particular areas or look at the whole threat? For example, can it look at everything?
Yeah, I think it can. It should. You know, that's our job. So, but having bounded the threat, so, you know, to your point on, you know, China, the Middle East, you know, the Southern Oceans. I mean, you can look, regrettably, anywhere in the world right now and find problems, for sure. So NATO has to recognise what it is and what it is charged to do, what the Washington Treaty requires of it, and ultimately what nations require of it. That's what bounds what NATO is about. But within that, then, if you consider those potential adversaries that I've already identified, then, yeah, we've got to be ready for anything.
Mike, let's look a little bit further forward. What do you think should be NATO's priorities, perhaps the next 5 years?
Well, I mean, there's any number of things that NATO needs to prioritise in the next 5 years, and DSAC has got to worry about them all the time. That's your job. You say that, you know, the job of the deputy is to take the blame and do the worrying for the chief, and I guess there's quite a lot of that. But my sense is, whatever happens in the next 5 years, the priority for the next year, 2025, is that Ukraine mustn't fail. Because if Ukraine fails, after all that we have said about sticking with Ukraine for as long as it takes, after all that we have said that this is a challenge to the liberal democracies, the global order, after all we have said we will do, if Ukraine fails in 2025, I think the fundamental undermining of our credibility, because the rest of the world is waiting to see what happens. More than half the world's population has stood off this event in Ukraine. They're waiting to see. And if what they see next year is Ukraine effectively being, in their perception, beaten, then I think NATO will suffer grievously in terms, whatever else it does militarily, it will suffer grievously in terms of its credibility.
Let me ask you the same thing, Admiral. You know, it's a fast-changing world. In the next 5 years, what are going to be the priorities?
So one of the things that I hope will now follow, given the profound nature of what we're seeing in Ukraine, and the fact that we're not on a bungee cord that's going to take us back to how things were before. That the world has changed, and therefore there is a lag in societies of orientating to that. So I would like a bit of societal orientation, not in a way that terrifies people, because that's not the game we're in either, but just in a recognition that this is a new security environment that we are operating in. Because once you've got that societal understanding, then things like defence spending and the value of defence and security become easier for people to work out for themselves. So at the moment, defence is arguably a bit of a hard sell to societies because people don't necessarily feel under threat. You wouldn't think that if you were in the Baltic nations or Poland. Mm. You'd have a different perspective. So there's something about that lag that needs to catch up, not to terrify people, but just so that we are well postured societally as well as through the militaries to be ultimately ready to deter and keep us safe and maintain our freedoms. And one thing we haven't spoken about, but it is linked, is the defence industrial base. So the capacity of defence industries to manufacture at the speed that we need them to is a very important part, actually, of deterrence. Because if we can make things faster than we can shoot them, and we can shoot them faster than the other guy can shoot them, then we're going to win. There's something about defence industrial capacity that I think we've really got to get after.
It's a good point to finish on. Sadly, after that, we've run out of time. We've covered all sorts of things. It's great to hear your thoughts. Thank you so much, Admiral Blount, for joining us today. Thank you to you, Mike. Thank you very much to the audience. It's been really great to have you here. Thanks for joining us. SITREP will be back as normal next week as well. But from us here, goodbye.